It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, winter doesn't officially start for another couple of weeks, but we're already seeing winter and holiday beers in stores. We'll talk to an expert about these seasonal brews.
First, heroin and opiate drug abuse have been a growing problem in Wisconsin in recent years. From 2008 to 2012, 56 of Wisconsin's 72 counties saw an increase in opioid-related hospitalizations for people ages 12 to 25. And Wisconsin's rate of drug-related deaths nearly doubled from 2004 to 2012, and many of those deaths were attributed to abuse of opiates.
Addicts are not the only ones impacted by their habits, with friends and family, as well as the community as a whole, seriously affected. One Wisconsin lawmaker has taken this issue on in large part because of his own daughter's struggles with heroin.
Jesse O'Poyan covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. Her article on heroin in Wisconsin was published today on Madison.com, and it's linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Jesse, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard a lot of data about opiate abuse and its impact, but can you sum up for us how big an impact heroin is having in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, you touched on some of the biggest and I guess most jarring statistics, but we're just seeing those massive jumps, and I guess it generally starts with opioid drugs and spirals into heroin use, and all of those numbers are growing up. So we're seeing, as people have been dealing with the heroin crisis, some of that use is actually going down, or at least heroin is harder to find in some counties, but law enforcement is saying, you know, prescription drug abuse is still growing.
Is it possible to trace back when heroin became a problem in Wisconsin to look and say, here's where it took off, and this is why?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that contributed, and you know, you can kind of look back and say all of these different things were happening, all of these different factors occurred to kind of let this storm brew over a number of years. So it was definitely sort of the early to mid 2000s, and a number of things, in part sort of nationally, prescription painkillers just became a lot more commonly prescribed for things like chronic pain, as opposed to being more designated for end-of-life use as they used to be. At the same time, the drug cartel distribution in the U.S. kind of changed, and the U.S. used to get most of its heroin from Asian cartels. It has started getting it more from Central and South America, and you know, it's crossing a shorter border, so it's becoming more pure. Kind of all of those things combining, just the prevalence of both, and when prescription drugs are harder to get, then people tend to turn to heroin.
Now, you tell this story through the eyes of recovering addicts and also through their families, and two of the people affected are Representative John Nygren of Marinette and also his daughter Cassie. Can you tell us a little bit about their story?
Yeah, and I should actually say I went to school with Cassie, so this was a kind of a personal thing for me too. But so Cassie started using, she started taking OxyContin when she was in high school, and it was given to her by a friend. She'd gone through some things, and it helped her sort of feel numb, and she liked that feeling. And in Marinette, where we're all from, there was a doctor around that time who was writing unauthorized prescriptions. It was very easy to get prescription drugs illegally for a short time. Eventually, he was sent to prison, and people turned to heroin. She was one of those people. So she overdosed a few years later, was sent to prison, served her time, came out and asked her dad if he could do something, because when she was there, she started to see there were a lot of people like her, a lot of young women, girls who had come from good homes, you know, had had all the things going for them that are supposed to keep you from doing drugs when you're growing up. And, you know, they're being sent to prison for first offense on heroin.
Now, John Nygren isn't just a dad. He's a legislator. He's in the Assembly, and he used this as a spur to get a lot of new initiatives, a lot of new bills across, and he's working on more. Tell us what he's done so far in the state.
Yeah, so far, in 2014, he had a package of bills that passed with unanimous bipartisan support, which I know you all know is fairly rare in Wisconsin in politics right now. But that first package of bills, it allows emergency responders to administer Narcan, which is a drug that reverses the effect of an overdose. It included a provision that allows people to have limited immunity if they're calling 911 or taking someone to an ER for an overdose. It requires people to use a photo ID to pick up prescription narcotics, and it encourages cities to hold prescription drug drives. You know, you can turn in your old prescriptions when you're done. And that also increased some money for treatment and diversion programs like drug courts.
We're talking right now with Jessie Opoyan. She covers state government and politics for the Capital Times, taking a look at Wisconsin's struggle with heroin. There's a piece of hers in the paper today, and it's linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jessie, what's on the horizon as far as legislation? You get at this again through the stories, and you heard from Cassie, for example, about what she thought might be needed going forward. What is up ahead?
Yeah, so while the first round of bills deal a lot with heroin specifically, there's a second package that was introduced this session that gets a lot more at the prescription drug aspect of this. So some of it's kind of in the weeds, requiring doctors who are prescribing narcotics to update. It's a prescription drug monitoring database, the PDMP. So they have to update that more quickly within 24 hours, and they need to check that before they prescribe prescription narcotics to a patient for the first time. Along with that, if police find a prescription drug container at, say, an overdose scene or a drug-related crime scene, they have to notify the person who prescribed those drugs that they found it. It also includes some measures to monitor pain management clinics under the Department of Health Services and asking methadone clinics to start tracking data and reporting it to the state. And there's a lot more to be done in terms of treatment facilities and expanding access to detox, things like that, but this is sort of what they're getting at this time around.
And what kind of role are drug courts playing in tackling heroin problems in Wisconsin?
Yeah, drug courts, and especially in Marinette County, which I focus on a little bit in the story, but they're growing. They're a lot more popular throughout the state, and they allow people to kind of go through a more personalized program that focuses a lot on treatment. So the goal is to have people coming out both sober and also not committing criminal activity anymore. So it can be, it's only for nonviolent offenders. So people who are being arrested maybe for first time use, not a violent crime, and they can go in. They might be sentenced to some jail time, but they'll be paired up with, you know, treatment, some people to do some individual counseling, maybe some group counseling. There might be drug therapy involved, drugs like Vivitrol or Suboxone that limit the cravings or limit the receptors that are feeling the effects of the opiates, kind of finding the right combination of things to help people get off the drugs, stay off the drugs, and stay out of crime.
And staying off the drugs, it's hard. Time and time again, in talking to the people you talk to in this story, the recovering addicts, you hear that it's not so easy, that it's something that it's almost expected that there are going to be setbacks and relapses. What did you hear about that part of it?
Yeah, it's incredibly easy, and it's definitely expected. And so even in drug courts that are having a lot of success in this right now, they know that it's absolutely likely and very possible that some of the people who are going through these programs will relapse. And for different people, I mean, everyone I talked to who had used or had a family member who had used drugs, it's something different that works for everyone. You know, for Cassie, she's going through drug court, and she's taking Vivitrol, which helps block the cravings and block those receptors. You know, for another man that I spoke with, he's been going to 12-step meetings and gone through a treatment facility, and that helped him. But there's no one magic bullet for everyone.
And for Cassie Nygren, let's wind up with her. She's, of course, the daughter of Representative John Nygren, and you spoke with her about where she is. She's been a spokesperson for recovery from heroin. Where is she right now?
Yeah, and so she actually, after she kind of came out as that spokesperson, she did relapse again, which is what put her in the drug court now. But she is right now working as a waitress. She's living in Green Bay. She's going through drug court. She's getting treatment. And, you know, every day is a new challenge, but she's doing pretty well right now.
Jessie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jessie Opoyan. She covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. Her article about Wisconsin's struggle with heroin was published today on Madison.com, and it's linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now it's the most wonderful time of the year for people who like dark beer. Winter and holiday brews are in season now, and they tend to be a little different from the fall and summer beers.
Robin Shepherd is here to talk about what we can expect with these seasonal beers. He's a regional beer writer and columnist for Isthmus Newspaper in Madison. He's also an associate professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison. Robin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how would you define a winter beer?
Winter beers are, they're kind of luscious in many ways. We often think of them as having more color. If you think of the change of the seasons from summer to fall to winter, so you go through the degradations of darker things. And so when we move from the fall, we see a lot more ambers and the beginnings of the black beers. And then by the time winter rolls around, winter beers are usually very colorful, full-bodied, and often a little warmer, a little higher in alcohol.
I tend to think of wintry beers and what I'm looking for as kind of a comfort food almost. In the summer, you want something crisp and refreshing. Winter, you want, like you say, something fuller bodied, something that feels more filling, whether it really is or not.
Yeah, I kind of think of it as long towards the end of summer, I find myself with a little bit of palate fatigue after I've drank so many, you know, crisp hoppy beers. You know, your palate kind of gets numb to that hoppiness after a while, and you begin to crave something a little different. So long about September, it's really wonderful when the Oktoberfests begin to arrive, because those are nice, easy ways to kind of begin the pursuit of the bigger beers. And then by the time late October, November rolls around, you've kind of ramped yourself up for some big full-bodied coffee stouts, and you're on the cusp of some really wonderful barley wines that are just perfect when the snow starts to fly.
You mentioned the beer gets darker, and it also, you said, gets warmer, which apparently means stronger. I've never heard that term before. That's interesting. But also, is there a correlation here between dark beer and alcohol content?
Well, not really. Color has to do with the malt that's in the beer, okay? And so you don't need to add a lot more malt to get a darker beer. Malt provides the sugars that help us with the alcohol side of the equation. But so really what you do to get a darker beer is you just have a more roasted malt. So when a beer is darker, it just means the malt has been more roasted, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we have more malt with more sugar to make it stronger. So it's a misnomer and sometimes unfair to beers to judge them solely on color, so to speak. The color is a rough guide, but it really, you can find dark beers throughout the year. You can find dark beers that are very light. For example, Guinness. You normally think of that as maybe the image of a heavy-bodied beer, right? Not so much. When you think of the alcohol content in Guinness is around 4.2%, Miller Lite is very similar to 4.2%. In fact, MGD, a step up from Miller Lite, has more alcohol than Guinness. So when you think of strength and what we call big beers, Guinness is really a very light, drinkable, sessionable beer, but it gets unfairly labeled as dark and heavy and threatening because of that big, bold black color and that wonderful ice cream-like head that it has with it.
We're previewing winter beers with Robin Shepherd. And Robin, let's start naming names. I'll throw out maybe a kind of beer that we associate with winter, and maybe you can tell us about some that you look forward to this time of year. So how about the porters out there?
Well, porters are just they're good any time, to tell you the truth. A porter is a lot like the Guinness. In fact, kind of Guinness took the porter style, and Arthur Guinness made it famous with his brewery in Ireland. So Guinness is kind of a slightly bigger brother version of the porter. The porter is a dark, wonderful. It can have some roasted chocolate notes to it. It's a black beer. It may range in alcohol from 4 to 6%. Very drinkable this time of year. I think that's a nice transition beer to begin to think about here in the fall as we ease our way into winter. And as it gets a little colder and you're looking for something a little bit more heavier in the mouth or on the tongue and maybe a little bit more warmth, you graduate up into the stouts and maybe into the barley wines.
And how about something like a Scotch ale?
Oh, those are wonderful. They often are lumped into a category what we call winter warmers, and those are beers that have, you know, a little bit more alcoholic warmth to them, but they have that wonderful sweetness to them. Scotch ales, there are kind of different versions of Scotch ales, but generally Scotch ales have a malt forward focus to them, so that means they're going to get some caramel and some biscuit tones. They're really kind of the comfort food of. They're the comfort type of beer for winter. Their alcohol, it can range from mild to strong, probably anywhere from 4 to 8%, depending upon where you're at on the spectrum of how you define the Scottish ale.
Now, with a few different kinds of beers, I feel like I see the word imperial thrown into the name. Is that a particular thing, or is that just sort of a grandiose statement from the brewer?
Well, this time of year, when you see the words imperial or robust, those tend to catch our eye in the winter season. Imperial is a kind of an American invention to a style. It's like putting an adjective on a word, and it normally means that they have ramped up the recipe, so it's bigger, it's bolder in flavor. Often that comes with some higher alcohol.
And when I think of winter, I think of warm spices. I think of you know, things like cinnamon and flavors like pumpkin. We see some pumpkin ales. How big a role do things like that play when it comes to beer?
Yeah, Veronica, that's a great distinction to make, because winter beers generally, at least for me, I'm looking for that malt, that comfortness of the sweetness side of it. And winter beers are really more of a genre than they are a style. Holiday beers, what you're describing, is really a subset of winter beers. And when you see holiday in the name, it often will mean that they've added some spice, or they've ramped up that spicy side. If you think of a pumpkin beer, which is the early fall version, add a lot more cinnamon, nutmeg. Around Christmas time, you get the holiday ales that might even have peppermint or mints in them. A few years ago, there was a beer that one of the local Madison brew pubs produced that was called Eggnog Sweet Stout. Had a little sprinkling of cinnamon, you know, right across that big frothy white head.
Wow. Well, Robin, before we're done, we make a lot of beer here in Wisconsin. You've tried much of it. For people who want to expand their beer horizons, maybe they're not the aficionados, give us a few brand names as starting points.
Well, in southern Wisconsin, the Great Dane Brew Pubs have, you know, a variety of choices right now. But one of their annuals that comes back here, at least it's the second time they've made it, is Belgian Prairie. And it's made as a Belgian triple, which is a wonderful kind of full-bodied, golden type of beer. But it has about 20% of Wollishine wine in it.
Huh.
So it's kind of a compromise in some way. So that's kind of a fun seasonal treat. I also look forward to the barley wines that are beginning. We're just sort of on the early edge of that season. A number of breweries like to kind of coincide the release of their barley wine with the first big snowfall of the year. And those are usually, you know, bigger, bolder, malty beers and fairly strong.
Can you give us a brand name for that one?
Well, the barley wines, Central Waters from Amherst Junction makes a wonderful barley wine. The barley wines from Lakefront are quite exquisite. They even do a few barley wines that are barrel-aged at Lakefront, I believe. The Great Danes have their Old Scratch barley wine that should be out a little past Christmas time. So mainly, if you look for the barley wine, there are a variety of breweries that will make them. They require a little advanced planning because they often take a little longer to age.
And we leave it there. Robin, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this has been fun.
It's Robin Shepherd, regional beer writer and columnist for Isthmus Newspaper, who is with us to talk about winter and seasonal beers.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Yesterday was the governor's Northern Wisconsin Economic Development Summit, when residents and business owners from the northern part of the state met to talk about important economic issues in that region. Coming up, we'll focus on the need for broadband in northern Wisconsin.
First, we're talking to a WPR reporter who was at that summit yesterday in Trigo. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Well, good. So job creation was a big item, not surprising, at this Economic Development Summit. What kind of job creation challenges are people seeing in northern Wisconsin?
Well, the landscape itself in northern Wisconsin can pose a challenge for development there. There's a lot of public land up here with the National Forest. You have county and state forest land, which is also good for the timber industry, and timber and tourism play a big role in the region's economy. But then you also have a lot of wetlands and state or federally protected waters. Plus the sheer expanse or geography and distance between communities in large cities like Duluth Superior or Wausau or Eau Claire, it can make it difficult to transport goods and services. It takes more time. Also, it's a very rural area where you see fewer people, much lower than that in metro areas like Madison or Milwaukee. And so there are challenges with finding a skilled workforce. And then you have infrastructure needs, too, with roads, rail, bridges, and docks, and all of that can tip the balance for or against economic growth.
We'll dig some more into those details, but this is a conference convened, as I understand it, by Governor Walker. He spoke there. What did he have to say about job creation?
Well, Governor Walker touched a lot on tax and spending cuts and how that's played a role. He touted the fact that property taxes are lower than when he took office, and for the most part, that's true. It can vary somewhat from community to community. He also cited that income taxes are down from where they were 5 years ago, and that that's keeping money in the pockets of businesses in the state, and that most businesses in the state don't pay corporate tax. So, regarding regulations and litigation costs, he says that the state's working more with business owners in order to help them through that so that they can avoid costly violations.
Who are some of the stakeholders who attended this conference?
The governor's cabinet, basically almost everyone was there. You had departments like the Department of Administration, the Public Service Commission, WIDA for housing. You also had the Department of Workforce Development. It really ran the gamut.
I mean, how about locals, business leaders and things like that?
As far as locals, I mean, you saw people from across 10 or 11 counties in northern Wisconsin, mostly people representing economic development, but also people representing their counties. A lot of those attendees that were there talked about things that they wanted to see as far as concerns over management of natural resources, because, again, that plays a big role in the timber and tourism industries there. And they also talked a lot about a lack of funding, or what they see as a lack of funding or loans to jumpstart small businesses or help out existing businesses and their ability to grow.
Well, WEDIC, I understand, was there, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. That's kind of their territory, though there's been controversy making loans to related to business, also tax credits. What do we hear from them at this summit?
Well, you're right in that WEDIC has definitely faced a lot of criticism over the last year for giving out millions in loans without formal staff reviews. But they say that there's a variety of programs that they have. They talked a lot about their Main Street Business Program and tax credits, bonds, loans, and grants that they provide to stimulate economic growth, and that they've offered around $245 million in financing. Created roughly 7,500 jobs. And so I spoke with Barb Lemieux. She's the Vice President of Economic and Community Development for WEDIC, and she talked about some of the work that they've been doing with northern Wisconsin communities and responded a little bit to their concerns with economic development there. And as far as loan assistance, she said that their programs, there's really no difference between whether they go to a large or a small company, which had been a concern of some economic development leaders in the north, and that they look to work with regional revolving loan funds for smaller projects under a couple of $100,000. But here's what she had to say about their loan program.
So our loan program in particular is based on job creation and capital investment. So depending upon the size and scope of the project, the value of our loan, you know, would be dependent on that. But we've done loans for companies that have been, under $100,000 if that's what it's needed to get the project to go.
And those capital investments would include equipment upgrades and things like that. So she says basically, you know, if communities don't have the resources, WEDIC is happy to step in and provide assistance wherever they can.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, about yesterday's summit on economic development in northern Wisconsin, convened by the governor, included his cabinet, business leaders, community leaders from around the area. So speaking of resources, one resource that's got a lot of attention over the past few years around the state, not just northern Wisconsin, human resources. And you mentioned this as an issue up there, having a skilled, trained workforce that can fill jobs should they be created. How did these issues come up in the summit yesterday?
Well, again, you know, northern Wisconsin is generally less populated, and the median income here is lower than that of the statewide average, so it's hard to attract skilled workers, and that's what Department of Workforce Development Secretary Reggie Newsom touched on yesterday when I asked him some of the common themes that came up during yesterday's summit, and here's what he had to say.
Workforce, infrastructure, again, one of the things we heard from the participants is that They want to make sure they have access to quality pool of workers, and doing everything we can to make sure that non-traditional pathways in education through tech colleges and work-based learning opportunities in our high schools is really, really important to make sure that we create a succession for the future workforce.
So those non-traditional pathways that he talked about, you know, he really talked about utilizing the technical colleges and high schools and how that's important, and cited some of the examples in northern Wisconsin, like the work that Wisconsin Indian Head Technical College is doing along with UW-Superior and North Central Technical College, and that they've been focusing more on trying to meet the needs of employers in the region with things like programming, more specifically welding programs for manufacturing. They've just begun a gerontology program at the technical college to address aging issues in the north, which is going to become more of an issue because there's an aging workforce here, and that's going to require people to fill those gaps as well and to take care of people who are aging out of the workforce.
That's one thing to create jobs here and there and a couple businesses, but a wider goal of economic development tends to be creating an environment that sustains job creation, kind of helps turn into a local job boom if possible. So think that kind of long-term thinking. How did that come up in yesterday's summit?
Well, when you're talking about sustaining economic development or providing that these communities have to ensure that the resources are in place to accommodate growth, whether that's roads or sewer infrastructure, you know, having an adequate education system or housing to allow for new families to move in, or also providing the technology to do business in a digital age. And that was a concern and a priority for Ashland County Board Supervisor Charlie Ortman. I spoke with him at the summit yesterday as well, and here's what he had to say about internet access in the region.
We need broadband. People have tried to locate here that worked on their own houses that needed internet, and they couldn't get fast enough speeds, so they left. And housing was an issue there. There were people, one of the realtors said that he's tried to find houses for people with a more substantial income than was usually there, and there wasn't adequate housing. So they addressed a lot of things that I think if they, you know, do what I hope they will and sincerely try to address the issues, it'll improve things up here.
And Danny, we'll get more into broadband with our next guest, but we've talked to you about infrastructure issues before, a sense that roads are sometimes neglected in state calculations of roadway funding. You mentioned housing there. How about that kind of physical infrastructure? Was that a focus at this summit?
Definitely. I mean, a lot of people in the smaller communities that don't have a lot of resources or have been affected by spending constraints that have been put forth in the last several years are looking for public assistance to help repair infrastructure that has just deteriorated over the years, whether that's dock walls, seawalls, roads in their counties, and also housing. You know, a lot of housing in northern Wisconsin, unfortunately, is dilapidated. You have some slumlords in the areas, too, unfortunately. And, you know, the Superior Mayor, Bruce Hagen, has complained a long time that they've seen people move across the bridge from Superior to Duluth because their housing hasn't met the needs of the people that come to work in the city, and that affects economic development directly because that means that more of their tax base is moving into another state.
Danny, I know there were a bunch of different people with a bunch of different perspectives at this summit, so this may be a tough question to answer, but could you assess the mood? Was there a sense of optimism that, hey, with a little help, maybe from the state, there's room for growth, there's a chance for improvement in the economy in northern Wisconsin?
You know, I'm glad you asked that, Rob, because I was talking to a few people after the summit yesterday, and I kind of expected a lot more skepticism or criticism, just because it's not very often that there's FaceTime with agency heads or government officials in northern Wisconsin. That's been a longtime complaint of people living in the north, that Madison doesn't really care about what's happening in the northern part of the state. But a lot of people at the summit that I talked to were very happy to be able to voice their concerns to agency heads and to know that they were listening, that they were reacting and taking their feedback and hopefully using it to benefit the northern Wisconsin economy.
Danny, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter based in Superior, with us to talk about the governor's Northern Wisconsin Economic Development Summit held yesterday in Trigo. We continue our look at yesterday's Northern Wisconsin Economic Development Summit in Trigo. We just heard from WPR reporter Danielle Koenig about some of the big issues that came up during that summit. We'll take a closer look now at the importance of broadband internet in Northern Wisconsin with Tom Wojciechowski. He is a community natural resource and economic development educator for UW Extension in Ashland County. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Well, as I understand it, at the summit, Governor Walker and others spoke about the need for broadband internet in northern Wisconsin. He announced a plan to expand access to broadband. What are your thoughts? What's your reaction on what the governor had to say?
Well, we're certainly very pleased that broadband got the attention it did at the summit this year. I would take a little takeoff on what Danielle Keating was saying, is that we're really happy they're listening. Broadband was brought up a year ago at the summit, and people listened. Funding was increased, and I think it got more prominent play at the summit this year. Very glad about that, but we also, on the other end, we have a long way to go, I guess. So,
yeah, tell us about that. What is access like, or not like, as the case may be, in northern Wisconsin?
You know, it varies greatly. We've got a few major providers up here. One of them, with some of the ERA funding from the feds a few years ago, was able to bury fiber to most of their customers, including Madeline Island, down in LaPointe, actually has 1 gigabyte service available if they want it. We have other parts of the counties that have dial-up, and a lot of them that have DSL, but it's very slow DSL. So it really is across the spectrum, across the not only Ashland County that I work in, but Bayfield County and the others up here. If you take a look at the Link Wisconsin maps, when I pulled up Bayfield and Ashland counties recently, the area that was eligible for these Connect or broadband expansion grants, almost the entire county was eligible. That means that much of our areas do not have the service that we really need.
When a lot of people think about internet access, they might think, okay, well, that's entertainment. It's nice. Your video's slower, things like that. But economic development people say, no, we need this stuff. This is important for business. Why is this important for economic development in your part of the state?
Yeah, this got on our radar about August of 2012. We actually had a business conference with the Wisconsin Innovation Network up here. And we had a panel of presenters who were all working from home. And one of them said, I do business across the nation. I need to send large files. I need to receive large files of graphics, et cetera. This person had 4 employees, I think, and was really a young and energetic, up-and-coming kind of a business, the type we'd love to have up here. Another one of those presenters worked for a multinational company. She needed to be connected with Europe in the morning, Southeast Asia in the evening, and really needed the connections that would make that possible. So that sort of brought it to our attention that, you know, there are a number of jobs in our counties where people are working this way. And we weren't quite sure where the issue was at the time. A year later, we had another panel, and a couple of small businesses were on a panel, and they did almost all of their sales via the internet, and they did it both nationally and internationally. And those were 2 examples that really got our attention about this is important for economic development. The other end of it is, and we've heard this through some of our colleagues at the Broadband and E-Commerce Center with Extension, they said, to the younger generation, if your business isn't on the internet, you don't exist. And that really hit us between the eyes, I guess, that if younger people are looking for, you know, name the business, if they can't find it on their iPhones or their iPads or something like that, they're not going to go there.
Well, I also think people might think, a business that needs the internet is an internet business. But I can think of, you know, a factory or a sales force might want online training tools. They might not be a high-tech product themselves, but they'll use that for their services and for their staff.
Absolutely. And with Extension, we've just gotten some of that remote capability. Ashland Area Development Corporation now has some of that equipment. So there's movement, I think, into the opportunity to do that type of training. I think it also gives us the opportunity to not have to travel to Madison, Milwaukee, the cities, or something like that, to get the type of training that's available and expected in those areas.
We're talking about broadband access in northern Wisconsin with Tom Wojciechowski. He's with UW Extension in Ashland County. And you mentioned the younger people, whether they need internet access, high-speed internet access for their business or not. This is something that people are, in a lot of places, probably taking for granted as a quality of life issue when they're off the job.
Mm-hmm. We're hearing that a lot from tourists, particularly, who are coming up to this area. And it spills over into cell coverage as well. Everyone seems to have their iPhone on them all the time nowadays, and or their smartphone. And they just expect to be able to find the restaurant options or the movie options or the hotels or a variety of other things. And when they get to parts of our rural highway system up here and their cell coverage drops out on them, they're a little bit at a loss. So we really need to be able to upgrade the cell coverage as well as broadband. And I think having broadband available at the coffee shops, restaurants, et cetera, is really important to those visitors.
So you're spreading this message, trying to raise awareness. For who? Who is it that needs to be at the table to start solving this?
Yeah, we've got a small group of us that have been meeting since that 2012 event. It involves a couple of the Economic Development Corporation directors, Bayfield, Ashland County, my colleague in Extension from Bayfield County. We've partnered with WITC on some of the events that we've done. They've got some of the training expertise and other capabilities.
The technical college up there?
Correct, yes. And we also need some of the folks from around the state. We've had representatives from the WEDC up here a few times. We've had Public Service Commission up here a few times. Certainly have had a lot of support from the Broadband Economic and E-Commerce Education Center out of Madison. All of those people and more. Oh, and I dare not forget, we've also had our providers at the table. Norvado, CenturyLink, Charter are primary providers up here, and it has been very helpful to have them at the table, talk about issues, figure out how can we all work together on this.
Well, I wonder, you know, if you're in a densely populated area, the numbers are real easy, I imagine, for a provider. We lay fibers underground or whatever. We've got a lot of people who want to pay us money for that service.
Mm-hmm.
In a less populated area, do you need something like subsidies to make that a reality?
A couple of the figures that the providers have provided us quite regularly. One is that up here it costs about $40,000 per mile to bury fiber. So that's one expense, and another number they throw out quite a bit is that in our rural areas, not our communities, but in our rural areas, we've got an average of about 7 homes per square mile. So if you take a look at that cost and you look at the number of possible customers in that area, it's a tough business plan to make the numbers work. So yes, I think we really need partnerships between government, the private sector, and anyone else that we can get in to help on this.
And for the speeds people are looking for, I have heard, I don't know if it's true, the only answer really is you're laying cables. Satellite is nice, it can get you decent speeds, but it's not really going to meet the needs that people are looking for in the business world.
And the one challenge I've heard with that as well is that there are caps on the amount of data after a certain amount, and that's a challenge. Also, satellite occasionally has problems with rainy weather, et cetera. That was one of the issues with that very first business person that I mentioned that did business in Europe and in Asia. It was a real disappointment for her when a call would drop or some of her coverage would miss. Her parent company, I think out of Minneapolis, didn't understand that type of dropping in technology. It was a real challenge for her. I believe that's been improved in her case.
So what kind of impact do you think the governor's announced plan yesterday to expand broadband will have on the area? How soon will you see results? What kind of results do you think you'll see?
I haven't seen the entire list of grants yet, but I think Iron County was awarded one. I think Vilas County was, and I think Bayfield County was, as well as Barron. So I think there's several smaller projects in those areas that are going to have immediate improvements by as soon as they can start putting fiber or whatever in the ground next year, or a tower in the case of Iron County, I think. I think one of the things we're looking forward to in Ashland County and other parts of the North is that CenturyLink has accepted what's called CAF II funding. It was from the Federal Communications Commission, and they'll be starting to deploy some of that funding to improve the speeds in their customer base. So I think all of these things coming together, we are hopeful, I think, as your previous guest had said, for the future.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's Tom Wojciechowski. He's Community Natural Resource and Economic Development Educator for UW Extension in Ashland County. He's with us to talk about broadband internet access in northern Wisconsin.